Network. Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
A reservoir in Portugal is set to be searched today by police investigating Madeleine McCann's disappearance. They'll start combing the area in the Algarve, around 50 kilometres from where the toddler went missing. Riots broke out in Cardiff last night after two teenagers died in a crash. Rumours were circulating that they were being chased by police. The Home Secretary has announced a national compensation scheme for victims of child sexual abuse in England. Suella Braverman says she hopes the scheme can help victims who have suffered.
This is a real problem of enormous scale and of devastating consequences. That's why I'm announcing a new redress scheme to ensure that victims and survivors can secure some finality, some acknowledgement of what they've been through.
And Kim Kardashian says being a parent is the most challenging thing, and she's had nights when she's cried herself to sleep. From Radio News Hub, I'm Edward Breslin.
At Lidl, we're big on a British summer. And what could be more British than a bank holiday sneaking up on you? Be prepared with two deluxe ultimate burgers for £2.99 and four deluxe brioche burger buns, just £1.10. All GHI approved. And top up those buns with two flavoured salmon burgers for just £1.49. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Subject to availability, selected stores excludes NI.
Coming up, Africa in Focus. Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio. Africa in Focus.
Africa in Focus is sponsored by Dermadew Lotion. Visit dermashark.co.uk.
Colorful Radio.
Good morning, good evening, or even good afternoon, depending on the time zone that you're connecting to us from. Welcome to Africa in Focus, and I'm your host, Julius Baluto. We're coming to you from the heart of London to wherever you are on Colorful Radio. Keep it colorful. And of course, now, wonderful, wonderful day. And today we focus our attention on the British agenda on Africa, or British agenda focused on Africa in this year, 2023. And to make us understand what this is all about, I had the privilege to join Andrew Mitchell, who is a Minister of State in the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office here in the UK, as he spoke and, of course, engaged people in conversation at SOAS, which is University of London, to all talk about Africa. So join us, and of course, to start us up, Andrew Mitchell first focused on the opportunities for investment between the UK and Africa. He also touched a bit more on conflict and of investment, key focus on Africa. So let's hear what he's going to say.
This is how you turn billions into trillions. It's the use of the balance sheets of the multilateral banks. That is the way in which we will be able to lend far more and produce far more income. And of course, to link with the private sector. People forget that pension funds available for investment total something like $60 trillion. And we've also seen through our own transformation of CDC, now British International Investment, that the private sector, which is so important to this, working with others, can generate enormous amounts of funding for successful projects. And we've seen them investing in ports in Somalia, a very good example of the intrepid and adventurous nature of this organisation, which deploys patient capital and pioneer capital. And we will next year have the UK Africa Investment Summit. It will be a very big occasion chaired by our Prime Minister, and will invite from many countries in Africa. They're leading politicians and business people to come to London, and I hope it will generate millions of jobs and billions of pounds in investment. So then if I move on to conflict, as I said in my earlier remarks, we see this in all its awful fury in Sudan today, but Britain is trying to focus on a number of things which are of particular importance to us. We believe that putting girls and women at the front of everything we do in development is vital. Women obviously suffer in ways with which we are all too familiar. They are absolutely horrific from conflict, and the work that my colleague Lord Ahmed and the British government have done on trying to stop sexual violence in conflict and protect women, I think, is extremely important and also effective as well. And in terms of family planning, we have launched a number of funds which directly affect the availability of family planning. One recently across the Sahel, which we launched when I was in Niger. We have to remember this lesson, I think, which we've been slow to understand. When we put in troops in Mali, and the French do indeed beat back the terrorists as they did, there is no point in doing that unless you address the social and economic indices underneath. If all that people, particularly women, see are shiny soldiers driving around with shiny weapons in shiny vehicles, that does not bind them into the state. What binds them into the state is the state being a provider of basic services, whether you can get your children educated, whether you've got perinatal services, whether there is proper healthcare, an opportunity for advancing your social and economic condition. And that's a very important lesson, I think, that was learned from Mali, that the one without the other simply doesn't work. Let me quickly say a word or two about food insecurity. We are going to focus this year particularly, I hope, in a summit towards the end of the year on the issue of child starvation and malnutrition. We know that this year there are 72 million people in acute need. The Dakar 2 Feed Africa Summit, which took place earlier this year, I thought did a very good job of getting people to focus on all of this. And in particular, that we need to build in resilience to humanitarian relief. When we try to go, as we have now for five seasons, to help people in the Horn of Africa who are suffering from drought, in the spend that we make to help them, we need to build in resilience and climate adaptation as well, so that the next time these natural disasters and weather events strike, there is greater resilience. For example, delivering water in water bowsers when you have a drought and people being very water insecure. We should always ensure that money is spent on retaining water and building reservoir capacity, so that the next time the crisis is not so acute. Let me also say on food insecurity that we are working actively with various partners on co-financing. I think that will increase what we can do as an international community in tackling all of this. And we need to do that because 82% of all the relief that took place in the Horn of Africa last year came from American support. And I don't think that is sustainable. Finally, let me just answer the question about partnership. This is a particular emphasis in terms of localism of SAMPAWA at USAID. I entirely agree with her about that. We have learnt a lot of lessons in the last 25 years. From the time when the IMF would send in smart-suited men from the IMF to tell Africans how to solve their economic circumstances, which simply didn't work because these were not the prescriptions that were practical in Africa. We learnt that the hard way, to the time when the World Bank was prescriptive about the way in which it said countries had to invest their money to deliver results. We know now that without partnership and real and genuine and equal partnership, none of these results will be obtained. And I want to...
This is Colorful Radio. Colorful Radio.
During life, your skin is subject to many conditions, leaving your skin rougher and tighter. We want to help. At DermaShack, our unique formula provides day-to-day moisture for all skin types. Our signature cream, DermaDew, is a cream that can be used for both specific areas of dry skin and as a daily moisturiser. So why don't you try our cream, Dermadew, an intense rehydration cream that leaves your skin like silk. Please go to our website, dermashack.co.uk, to see our skincare range and begin your journey into total moisturisation. Dermadew, total body cream, complete moisturisation.
One of the things that has bedeviled Africa is lack of representation when it comes to the international system. We're talking about United Nations, you're talking about UN Security Council. And of course, lately, focus has been on the campaign by Africa to be given at least two seats at the United Nations Security Council. Two permanent seat. And why is that important? Africa is a whole continent with some 54 countries, a population of over 1.3 billion people. And that being the case is pretty much bigger than, for example, Britain. And Britain happens to be a permanent member on the Security Council. And of course, this campaign being wenched, it's not just a new thing, it's been there before. Former president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, campaigned all his life for transformation of the international system, especially focused on the United Nations. But of course, so we are not hearing something new. Will it happen? And if so, how will it happen? You'll be surprised to hear, for example, Minister of State here in the UK talking about, yeah, we have no problem supporting Africa to have those two seats. And we want to say that that would be Nigeria and South Africa. So the key question is, anything that is of interest to Africans, is it Britain that should be choosing for them? Or if it was to be the case whereby United Security Council gives Africa the right to have two permanent members in the Security Council, is indeed now a matter of the African countries coming together to make that decision, to decide who is going to represent them? Is indeed a matter of African to choose? That's what I'm talking about. Of course, it didn't stop there. We talked about other things like the presence of Russia, the presence of China on the African soil, not forgetting the plight of the Sudanese people as we speak. Let's hear this.
When I was in Niger, I announced out of order that Britain would strongly support Africa having a seat at the G20, and that is now happening. And of course, in terms of partnership, we've been very clear that Africa should have seats on the UN Security Council, and Britain has said that both South Africa and Nigeria should do that. In terms of partnership and competition, there is a competition going on in Africa between the values that we hold and the values that China and Russia hold. I don't think I need to spend very long on the disadvantage of what Russia is seeking to do in Africa. And if the answer to any question in Africa is Russia, we need to have a very good look at what the question was in the first place. But China is different. There is a China development offer in Africa which is appealing. But all I would say is that we believe, and this is the final point I will make, we believe that we have a relationship with the people of Africa and the people of the countries above all. China's relationship is nearly always with the elites, and we believe that the right and enduring relationship is one with the people. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm making a speech later this week where I'm going to tie together what Britain needs to do to reassume the leadership which we have had in the past. I will in fact, be making this speech on Thursday at Chatham House, for which I hope you will forgive me. But I will then try to set out in some detail how Britain reassumes that mantle and drives forward both the aims of the SDGs and the aims we have through the COPs on climate change. I will try and assert that dealing with climate change and dealing with poverty are not two different endeavours, but that they are both two sides of the same coin. And I very much hope that we can reassert the core things which bind us to Africa, and I hope also bind us all together in the values that we share. That's a very quick romp over the exam question you sent me, but thank you very much.
I think you need to join me in applauding Right Honourable Mitchell again. That was 105%. As people know, I often do. I like to take copious notes. I liked what you said about the essence of development is to stop conflict, and you explained that. You also said climate and poverty are the same sides, different sides of the same coin. You covered mobilizing the private sector, focusing on women and girls as a way to have resilience, food insecurity, the importance of partnership and the importance of partnership with Africans as you support Africa. You made some commitments on behalf of the Global North, UN Security Council, G20 membership.
Not so much commitments. I was rehearsing a long-standing UK government policy. We do believe that the UN as currently constructed on the post-Second World War facts of life is well capable of being updated. Of course, it's a very complex issue, as you will know very well.
Yes, I do. And sorry I used the term commitment, but if it was just left to you, Africa would already have representation on the UN Security Council. So I hope that we at the Royal African Society and SOAS and others who agree with you can help continue to encourage others to come on board on something that you've been talking about for some time. You also talked about the competition of values. I haven't heard this said in this way, between the UK's style versus Russia and China. I also just liked how pragmatic you were, and also how, I mean, you talked about the fact that the COP promises haven't been kept. You talked about the fact that we're now in the UK at 0.55% to GNI, dedicated to development. And you gave some jarring stats. I like the Niger one. I think you said 500
football
matches
every day.
Every day. Because I wanted you to confirm that it was every day you meant. I mean, that's
why
it's really significant. I mean, it's jarring.
That's why it's terrific. I mean, the other, Niger, was a very profound education. The president told me that in the region of the country he comes from, 52% of all girls are married by the age of 15.
Oh, my God.
And mostly they are also pregnant, which I thought was one of the most horrific statistics I had ever heard. But it underlines why, as part of the international development strategy we have in Britain, we put girls and women right at the forefront of everything we do in development. And I learnt many years ago that unless you see development through the eyes of girls and women, you miss such a large part of what really matters.
That's marble. Words are marble. Yes. You actually answered all the exam questions that I had for you. It'll be good for you to be more specific about Sudan. I mean, it's been in the news for the last for the last 10 days, literally, and. When I talk to various stakeholders, particularly Africans, they worry that part of why Sudan is where it is that the West focused on Ukraine and Russia and didn't really focus on some of the things that were going on. And then now it's come to a head. We're running to try and solve Sudan, and there are other conflicts happening on the continent. So if you can be more specific about your guidance, first of all, the UK's planning, but more general guidance about how we bring some of these conflicts to an end and have the UK focus a bit more generally and not when something has gotten out of hand.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis. I mean, I think our part, whether or not if we have been right on top of what's happening in Sudan, it would be any different. Because, of course, this is not an ideological contest. It's about power. And it's two generals fighting for power. And, you know, we went into crisis mode. We have 200 officials working together across government seamlessly in the crisis centre in the Foreign Office. And that's been the position now for nearly a week. And in the last week, I spent two nights working on this. And indeed, we had a meeting at 3:15 in the morning, and chair of COBRA a few days ago, chaired by the Prime Minister. And we've evacuated our diplomats and their dependents in a brilliant military operation yesterday morning. And thank goodness it worked as we had hoped it did, and we got them all out. One was delayed, but it's now in Djibouti. We got them all out, and we got all the military soldiers who took part in it back as well. And we did that not because we just wanted to take our diplomats out and leave the rest of the British citizens go hang. It was because the diplomatic community was being targeted in a totally lawless, no-ceasefire binding atmosphere, and with one European diplomat held up at gunpoint, they were breaching the boundaries of their properties, and the British embassy was between the two lines of fighting. So we took the decision, we had no choice, we had to take a very risky way to deliver what was essential, and thank goodness it worked. So we are in crisis mode over this. Of course, what is required is a ceasefire. And one that binds all the ceasefires. I mean, three or four ceasefires so far, which have not bound people in. And what we need is a ceasefire. Every sinew of British diplomatic effort, including at the United Nations where we held the pen, is bent on achieving a ceasefire. But also, we are looking at every single conceivable option to evacuate those of our citizens who want to leave. And we will continue to do that until the crisis eases. But you know, there's a deep shortage of food and water, and the five humanitarian people have been killed. So there's an evacuation and an exit of key humanitarians when water and indeed food is running low. It could not be worse, actually. And we will do everything we can to make our
contribution. And it's after 17 coups.
Yes.
In Sudan. And after, I think it was 2019, that they did have a civilian government who was actually, it was led by a former colleague of mine at the African Development Bank, Mr. Haddock. Saying that they've just, I mean,
I spoke to him at length on Friday night. I mean,
what does he think about what they've
Well, he is I think, completely focused on getting back to the objective of negotiating and restoring civilian rule. And that must be the way forward. I mean, I used to march when we were in opposition against Bashir. I remember walking through the streets of St. James's by the Sudanese embassy chanting, "Send Bashir to the ICC." And indeed, when he was arrested, we thought for one glorious moment we might actually get him there, which would be a triumph for ending impunity and accountability. But that's somewhere off.
But that's another case for your idea of having a more holistic approach to
yes.
development and ending conflict. So it's another case.
Colorful radio.
Colorful radio.
Of course, the Minister of State took some questions, and of course, one of the key issues is the unfair or unbalanced, what they call partnership when it comes to economic engagement, when it comes to trading. There are issues that they make the whole relationship between Africa and the UK pretty much unbalanced. Let me give you an example. We talk about a lot of brain drain, a lot of narcissists, you know, trained on the soil in Africa. What happens if they get recruitment in the UK? You know, when we talk about partnership, isn't it supposed to be two equal partners coming to transact at equal footing? What does all this mean? Let's hear what Andrew Mitchell is going to say.
Yes, I'd like to switch to climate. You already shared some perspective, and I liked what you said, as I said earlier, around climate and development being two sides of the same coin. We are actually, as secretariat to the All Parties Parliamentary Group on Africa, focusing the inquiry this time on Africa's energy transition. You know, we've done one on visas because it was a big issue for particularly researchers and others to get visas. We did an inquiry on including African studies into the education curriculum. So this time, with the guidance of the APPG, we're actually focused on the net zero strategy on Africa's energy transition. And I want to give a shout out to Afriex Bank that has already given us some money for that. And if we have any other funders, we'll be delighted to get some money as well. But I liked what you shared around the fact that the promises are yet to be met. There's the issue of, you know, the issue of $100 million per year has been overtaken by loss and damage. And I haven't heard very much about loss and damage since COP 27 in Egypt. I'd like to hear from you what you think a just transition should be, which in my view is one that takes account of Africa's perspective, and how the UK can support African countries in focusing on a just transition.
Very interesting points. I mean, firstly, I would say that, and you might say I would say this because money is very tight, but development, of course, is about an enormous amount more than money, and we do have an ability here to deploy technical expertise to help people get through the gateway. Because if you had a magic wand and all this money was available, there would not be a sufficient pipeline of oven-ready projects around the world to absorb it. And we need to focus on both supply and demand. I think that is particularly important. And also, in a country like Somalia, you know, they've got key people there running the country. But in terms of the expertise of getting through that gateway, as I said in my remarks, you know, they need and deserve and should get support so that they can, you know, get the documentation right, so they can move forward on adaptation, particularly, but also on mitigation. So we need to find ways of doing that. And I think technical expertise can be deployed very effectively to help, and that's something that we would want to do. I mean, also, particularly, reverting to the Bridgetown agenda, you know, Mia Motley said to me, I get to lift it from my speech later this week, she said to me, it's extraordinary to her that you can save this enormous bank in California in 3 days. Yes. Ghana's up to 2 years still waiting for the creditors to sort out their position. Zambia is still waiting. Ghana's still waiting too, but Zambia is the particular one that I was thinking of. And, you know, it's true that the international community can invent quantitative easing to sort out their problems, but they can't find the money to save the planet. You know, these seem to me to be a completely legitimate viewpoint. And the anger that you mentioned, and I tried to mention as well, about, you know, what is happening in Ukraine and the impact that has on development in other parts of the world. The only thing I would say is I always thought that loss and damage as a sort of fund I think there are handling issues with that, but for the purpose that it is not good enough for the rich countries to say that they have their industrial revolution, they were able to drive up the standard of living of their citizens through, you know, coal and oil and all that flows from that, and that because of climate change, developing countries can't do that. You know, that isn't good enough, and we have to factor that into the debate.
Thank you. Now, I promised that I'd ask two questions and then hand it over to people in the room who may want to ask questions. And remember, oh my God, So I'll take several questions. I think education are really doing a great job. So I'll take several questions at a time, and then hand over to the writer of the show to respond. I'll start from my far left. And please introduce yourself and one question or comment, and as concise as possible.
My name is Lawrence Cockcroft. I'm associated with Transparency International. I would like to raise the issue of Rwanda in the following sense. We all know, and you're very, obviously very close to the point, that the repatriation to Rwanda of refugees is still very much on the agenda. When this was originally proposed, the government said that this is justified partly by reference to the fact that Rwanda has a good record on human rights. We now have a huge conflict in Eastern DRC, led particularly by MR23, and the Secretary of State for US, whom I'm sure you're in touch with, Antony Blinken, has said that that is an extremely bad blotch on the record of Rwanda, who should cease aiding the elements in M23 that it supports. A few minutes ago, you were talking about nascent conflicts. This sure is a nascent conflict, burgeoning all the time, and it's going to get much worse. So I think your remarks that relate to Sudan, which are entirely appropriate, also need to be applied to that mega conflict, which, as I'm sure you know extremely well, has already caused 600,000 people to either move or die.
Thank you. There's a woman in the... Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Right Honourable Minister. Alice Mokwe Botswana and SOAS. I'm very interested to know what you believe equal partnership looks like, because you spoke about lessons learned, both through the COVID experience as well as through development aid experience. We're seeing in Botswana that NHS is advertising for nurses. We're also seeing that private companies from the UK are travelling in Africa, actively recruiting our nurses from countries which have struggling health systems. Does that look like a move towards equal partnership? So the question is, what does equal partnership and development look like? Thank you.
Thank you. There is another woman here.
Thank you. Thank you, Right Honourable Andrew Mitchell. My name is Stella Okuzu. I run an Africa-focused consulting practice. My question derives from the statement you made about development being stopping conflict. And the first thing that hit me was, how about a different perspective of preventing conflict, and such that the great work UK government has done would be more effective? I'll give an example. There are loads of examples. So, for instance, the unemployment levels in Nigeria, as of 2020, were about 33%. That is expected to rise to 40%. So do we wait until there's another youth uprising to stop that conflict as opposed to addressing it now? Thank you.
But we have... the women are more... Okay, there's a guy in the back, please. Yes, the one with... Yes, I'm looking back.
Hi, Elliot from G3, a risk consultancy focused on Africa. I wanted to ask about the reduction in the UK's overseas development budget. Do you think that's going to undermine our ability to bring influence to bear in the situation in Sudan? Thank you.
So let me start at with the last one first. I mean, you know, it's the fact of life that we are spending less money now than we were before, but we are actually spending about the same amount as when I was last in government 10 years ago. And it's a very different atmosphere today. I think that is partly because of some of the other decisions that have been made. But the way in which we're seeking to tackle this is by finding other multipliers. Often they don't score against our ODA targets, but let me just mention three. We do some co-financing. We did some co-financing in the Horn of Africa on humanitarian relief, and we are going to do much more of that as well. That bulks up the funding that for things that Britain is trying to lead. That example is in the humanitarian space, but if you look, for example, at the Africa Development Bank, we've developed this very successful way of helping the bank keep its AAA status while also being able to lend more by the provision of guarantees. And Britain has provided, I think, $2 billion of guarantees for the Africa Bank, which then means that they can lend on rather more than that. So that's another multiplier. The third one I would mention is insurance. You know, insurance money. You can't obviously insure against a crowd in Somalia next year, but what you can do, the insurance market will always be interested if you're insuring against an atypical series of weather events, and they will insure for that. And we've now got very substantial sums of money, both in the Caribbean and in Africa, which are being paid out as a result of that route. So there are multipliers we can bring to bear, and you know, it is what it is on the cut in the 0.7. We managed to get £2.5 billion out of the Treasury to help us because of the amount that is spent under the OECD DAC rules in respect of first-year asylum costs. But I hope that will give you some encouragement that we're not just sitting wringing our hands, we're actually trying to get on with it. On what Delacuse said about stopping conflict and prevention, I completely agree. When I say stopping conflict, I mean everything to stop actions which lead to conflict. And that clearly includes all the things you've said, and I think what you say is absolutely correct. Alice asked about equal partnership and nurses in Botswana. I introduced a bill as a backbencher last year which said if ever we pinch a doctor or nurse or a clinician from a developing country, we have a duty to pay from the development budget for two replacements for that person. Goes. And this is a live issue in government. What the government would argue is that many of the people who come to this country as doctors and nurses stay here for 2 years, maybe a little bit more, but they add to their training and they then go back to their country. And that seems to me to be an entirely sensible approach. But I absolutely recognise the point that you made that taking doctors and nurses from poor countries is a form of reverse aid for Britain, and it's not acceptable unless they are adding to their training here, taking back that skill to their country to assist the growth of the health system. And finally, Lawrence, on Rwanda and asylum. I mean, I don't think there are human rights issues myself for the proposition that we will send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Rwanda has an enviably good record in helping people, for example, caught off the coast of Libya, bringing them there and giving them a new life. And there are people who have spoken about the impact of coming, being offshore and trying to get to Europe, coming back into Africa and being looked after and trained in Rwanda. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. When I was not governed by collective responsibility and was criticising the scheme, I was criticising it not on the Rwanda end, but on the grounds of cost. But the Prime Minister has now done most of the things that we as backbenchers said needed to be done to stop this incredibly dangerous slave trafficking business of bringing people across the channel. Prime Minister, having drilled into the issue properly, has come up with a whole series of measures which, joined together, you will have noticed, have quieted the opposition on the Tory backbenchers which existed before. In terms of the M23 and the DRC, Britain has made it absolutely clear that we condemn all violence that has taken place in the east of the DRC and in the north and south Kivus. We condemn that. I mean, I think it's a complex situation because, of course, the colonial border divides up Tutsis, who are often related to those who are in Kigali. So it's a complex issue, and we should have a certain humility in addressing it in very stark terms. But be in no doubt that whether it's the M23 or the lack of order that the DRC government is presiding over at the east, We condemn all violence. We are very conscious of the impact. When I was last in government, I went into the Kivus with the United Nations, and I saw for myself and I heard from women leaders there about the impact of all of this on their lives. And it was a heart-rending, gut-wrenching experience to see the appalling circumstances that exist there. And I think I'm right in saying that something like, over the course of this long conflict, something like 5 million people have lost their lives. So the scale of death and disaster there is immense.
This is Colourful Radio. Colourful Radio.
During life, your skin is subject to many conditions, leaving your skin rougher and tighter. We want to help. At Dermashack, our unique formula provides day-to-day moisture for all skin types. Our signature cream, Dermadew, is a cream that can be used for both specific areas of dry skin and as a daily moisturizer. So why don't you try our cream, Dermadew, an intense rehydration cream that leaves your skin like silk. Please go to our website, dermashack.co.uk, to see our skincare range and begin your journey into total moisturization. Dermadew, total body cream, complete moisturization.
And finally, Andrew Mitchell addressed the issue of refugees. He talked about corruption and he talked about Africa's self-determination. But is it happening? Is Africa self-determination happening? Will corruption ever end?
Let me ask mine, because I think we're running out of time, and I got your office to give me 5 more extra minutes. So I'll put in some of my own one of my own questions, which is very important. So we have because we our membership at the Royal Africa Society is individual membership and the corporate sector, and I see my vice chair Jide Olorowaju, who is a partner at TPG, and I see a number of others, and of course you and Chinelo have met, who runs the Africa Investment Platform of the African Development Bank. I really liked your response about the multiplier effect. So the approach is, we will put our own money as much as we can, but we'll try and create instruments that enable us make sure that sufficient resources are coming to Africa. If I was a private sector person, and you were making the case in Africa, what is the case that you make?
Oh, I think it's overwhelmingly about the development of renewable energy. It is the opportunities in what used to be called pro-poor business investment, businesses which actually really helped build the sinews of state provision and so forth. And also, I think with people like BII, I mean, this is the real example. BII is the British Government's Development Finance Institution, and it's 100% owned by the taxpayer, private sector investor. There are those in the audience who will remember that 10 years ago it had 47 employees, it was just a fund of funds. And we brutally reformed it in opposition. But, you know, the deal is that the shareholder determines what happens. And as a result of that, they've now got 600 people. They're specialists. They are investing in the developing world. And consider this one statistic. Over the last, I think it's 5 years, they've paid tax, won't always be well spent, but they've paid tax of, I think, $10 billion. Extraordinary amount. Principally in Africa, and they are employing directly and indirectly 1 million people. So potentially that's 1 million homes, families with food on the table, and they're investing in a port in Somalia, I mean, which is quite a ballsy thing to do. So their example, providing, as I said, pioneer and patient capital, it's the pioneer point, and I believe the private sector should follow that. And with the UK-Africa Investment Summit next year, there will be a strong import opportunity for them to engage with entrepreneurs and business people and politicians from Africa and in the UK to drive forward.
I remember that Andrew Skipper on our council, Nick Westcott, our CEO, and I were at the relaunch of their strategy with you at the London Stock Exchange. I believe it was in November 2021. I've been fascinated by what they've done. I'm on the board of FSD Africa,
yes.
The Financial Markets deepening agency. So that's another tool the UK government has used to try and support patient capital, but also pioneering financial structures to help. So I'll turn, I'll take my next set. I'll start on this side. The man who's sitting in front. There are two men sitting in front. So this, him and then him. And then... please go ahead. No, go ahead.
Thank you, Minister Mitchell. My name is Ayo Adedoyin. I lead a diaspora NGO in the UK. And my question is that if conflict is development in reverse, would you say that the development is growing faster and outpacing what is a clearly escalating insecurity crisis right across Africa, particularly the Sahel and Nigeria? It'd be great to hear your comments.
He had raised his hand first as well. Where are the women?
Thank you so much.
In this group, in this area.
Just a quick comment. Friday was Eid, and coincidentally, it was also the Queen's 97th birthday. I'd like to take this opportunity to give tribute to the great work that she's done, and also to look forward to a partnership with the UK, and look forward to the coronation of the King in the summer. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a woman here.
This is the same woman again?
No.
There's another woman. Alison, okay, sorry, yes, please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Waifu. I run an Africa-focused legal consultancy. And I was quite interested and enthused to hear you say that the UK relationship is with the people of Africa, as opposed to China, that appears to have a relationship with the elite. I think we would like to hear more exactly about how UK implements its strategies in this respect, because with a number of people from Africa, they are really struggling with self-determination and ensuring that their voices get heard and they run their governments in the way they think is robust and viable. Example comes recent Nigerian elections, where a number of Nigerians are thinking that it hasn't actually, their voices haven't been heard. So in this respect, I think Nigerians will really, and other African countries will want to hear how the UK invests in relationship with the people of Africa. Thank you.
Sorry, the gentleman in the back. Yes, and Nico needs to take the, because I'm trying to maximize the time that I have left. While you go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Mohammed Emersi, and I chair the Emersi Foundation. The question I had is not one that was in the exam question, but it's an important question, and it'd be useful to have Andrew Mitchell address it. And this is the question of corruption. And on corruption, we have now seen the UK assume a very assertive position to using sanctions against Russians that were supportive of the Putin's regime. And so the question I have is that there has been so much stakeholder abuse in Africa, both in terms of corruption, in terms of human rights abuse. The democracy index indicates that it's sliding down. Before the Africa summit, is there any plans to use the tools of sanctions to go after the stakeholders that are engaged in corruption? Because that will show a real intention of the UK to clean up the act there and permit for clean business to be engaged in. Thank you.
We'll have one final question, because I've actually eaten up the 5 extra minutes I was given. And I also need to acknowledge that we have a number of questions coming from online participants. One of them was the issue around how do we justify spending aid on refugees in the UK? And I think there are a number of others. But it feels like, Right, Honourable Mitchell, we're going to have to send many other questions to your office, because there's so many questions online, and I'm just taking the one that is the most common. So please go ahead. Okay, will you give me an extra 5 minutes, Amy? Or no?
We have to leave.
Okay.
Just get one more question, and I'll try and knock them off.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello, thanks. I'm Joseph Bremer from Art Group International. We work with supporting SGBs across Africa to access finance and fundraising efforts. The issue of access to finance in Africa is huge, particularly for small growing businesses and those that are pioneering solutions to advance the SDGs. What we have found in our work repeatedly, and the academic research backs this up, is that whilst funding is available, particularly from the likes of USAID and FCDO, it disproportionately goes to foreign-owned firms in Africa rather than domestically-owned businesses. This is mainly because the grant landscape isn't equitable and domestic firms don't have familiarity with applying for investment, grants, bid rating experience, etc. So I would like to know what the UK government is going to do to make the process in applying for grant funding, particularly from FCDO, more equitable for African-owned small growing businesses. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. So on that last question, I mean, I'm not sure whether you're talking about investment in business or grants. We do invest through PIDGE, for example, which is one of the British investment tools, along with the Export Credit Agency and so on. We do invest specifically in indigenous businesses. And if you were to talk to BII, they would tell you that a lot of their business relationships are backing businesses that have already been established, that are African in every way. So I think it's probably a longer discussion, but we are very alive to the importance of that. You had the online question about spending aid on refugees. I mean, the short answer to that is that under the OECD DAC rules, it's very clear that the expenditure on people coming here seeking asylum in the first year is an eligible expense under those rules. And I'm very wary of supporting opening up the way the rules operate, because I know that there are predators out there who will be seeking to take the money for things that we wouldn't necessarily regard as development. So I'm very wary of that. The rules do get tweaked from time to time. You have to have agreement from everybody. Everybody turns up with their shopping list of how they would like them changed. So changing the rules is not easy. But I'm obviously concerned that there could be an attempt from other parts of the British government to spend aid money on wider objectives. And I would be very wary of that. Mr. Mercy's point about corruption and sanctions. I mean, corruption is the cancer that afflicts development, because people shy away from a lack of transparency and a lack of the rule of law, and corruption is at the heart of that. I can reassure you that one of the seven priorities that the Prime Minister set out in the integrated review refresh that was published a couple of months ago is specifically clamping down on dirty money and money laundering and corruption. And Britain, you know, we have a big dog in the fight on money laundering, because a lot of it comes through London and British territories. So we are very live to that. And I hope we're going to be able to do more on clamping down on money laundering and dirty money. Elizabeth asked a very interesting question about how African self-determination, mentioning particularly the Nigerian elections. I had the privilege and pleasure of seeing all the major candidates, or four of the major candidates, plus the Electoral Commission, when they came to London before the elections. And, you know, what the way we interact specifically, to the point you made, is through supporting civil society and election monitoring and so forth. The support for civil society is how we try and ensure that the voices of people in Africa, rather than elites, are heard. And I think that is very, very good expenditure. Gentleman over here mentioned Her Late Majesty and the King. Thank you very much for what you said. I mean, the truth is that the King, through the Commonwealth, has quite extraordinary convening power. And, you know, we know through his great interest in climate change and his great interest in a lot of the issues that the Commonwealth cares about, we care about, that he can really move the dial, and we honour and respect that, and we try to use it you know, whenever we can. The final question was about, which is quite a long question, is about the growing insecurity across the Sahel, this whole belt of Africa, through you know, from the left-hand side to the right-hand side, from northern Nigeria across the Sahel, and then heading down through Sudan and into Somalia. And I was in Somalia just before Christmas, and I noticed that things were very much better than when I had been in Mogadishu 10 years before, and driving up to the Villa Somalia from the airport. When I was there 10 years ago, every single building was shot up. No one was on the streets. There were critical feeding stations along the way on the left-hand side. And indeed, while I was in the Villa Somalia, there was a round of machine gun fire outside. This time, lots of people around. Many of those buildings have been rebuilt. Lots of markets. And the truth is that, touch wood, you know, we are beating back al-Shabaab in Somalia and giving the country, helping the government of that country, very good president, reassert the opportunity to show good governance and show why supporting a central government has got some value to your life and economic and social circumstances. So there are bright spots. And I talked about the lessons of Mali, about what you have to do to try and build back security and ensure that people do not fall prey to terrorist recruiters. I think there's a lot more work to be done on that. I think the fund I mentioned, the £33 million we are putting into this new Sahel fund, which will particularly seek to help women, above all to determine whether and when they have children, to have the right to family planning and so forth. I think those are things which can help, but there's no doubt at all that the challenge of security across Africa, made infinitely worse by what is happening in Sudan, is a very big challenge indeed.
This is Colourful Radio.
Africa in Focus.
You should clean your eyes, it ain't shining. Lately I've been running through this money like a lineman. Machine, she gotta say that in advance. Alexander McQueen's, I ain't rocking Vans. Rap, it's on lock like a sentence. Racing to that check, photo finish. Gotta have some longevity.